What is going on, everybody? Welcome to A Theology of Hustle. I'm your host, Curry Blanford, and today I'm talking to Susie and Cy. So Susie and Cy reached out about their incredible book called Keeping the Faith, Reflections on Politics and Christianity in the Era of Trump and Beyond. And so I thought for sure we needed to have them on. I've probably talked about politics, as you well know, like more time over the summer than I have the whole time I've done the podcast. But I think you're seeing in me even a growth in understanding these things. This is not a part of me that was ever really, like, I've never been like super political. I would not call myself that even now, but I think we're at a point in just where we're at in the world that we need to be thinking through these things. And all that we get from a lot of these discussions is just like vitriol and like bad arguments and just people sort of yelling across each other. And I think that's against what we should be doing, the biblical way of operating in these things. And so Susie and Cy in their book kind of like approach this conversation from a lot of different angles, showing that Donald Trump isn't the de facto Christian, quote unquote, political candidate, and just showing why that is from all these other arguments. And I think the cool thing about this book is if you're a conservative, it will challenge you. And if you're super progressive, it will challenge you. And I think that's a good thing. I think we need to be reading stuff that will challenge us. And we delve into several of these arguments in this episode. Both of them have amazing backgrounds. We dig into some of their story and also just like the stories of some of the authors, this collection of essays in their book. So I highly encourage you to check out the book, check out what they have going on. And yeah, I think this is going to be a really powerful episode. There's some great stuff in this one. I just want to remind you before we get to the interview that you can make sure you're following me on Instagram and Facebook at Theology of Hustle and on Twitter at Curry Blanford to stay up to date with the podcast. I do have something new out called Bootleg Bible College, which is a YouTube series. We're just finishing up a series on the Hebrew Bible, where the Hebrew Bible comes from, how it comes down. We talk about the Septuagint, all sorts of fun stuff. So I encourage you to check out Bootleg Bible College if you're interested in finding out more about the Bible in general and about theology. So go check all that stuff out, and I hope you enjoy hearing from Susie and Cy. All right. Well, Susie, Cy, I can't thank y'all enough for making time for me and coming on the podcast. It's super fun to chat.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you so much. We're really excited to have this conversation with you.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. Okay, so let's just jump. How about, so we're here talking about a book that is released that y'all have spent a lot of time working on. So why don't we start off by y'all sort of introducing the book and the project to everyone, and then we'll sort of navigate from there.
Well, it was Susie's brainchild, so I'll let her start, then I'll add on.
Yeah, so Keeping the Faith, Reflections on Politics and Christianity in the Era of Trump and Beyond, it's an anthology of dissent. It's a collection of 36 essays and articles by Christians from across the political spectrum, from diverse backgrounds, coming from different places, to the conclusion that Donald Trump is not the de facto Christian candidate in this election. And so it's sort of challenging that mainstream notion and trying to present another side of the story that we felt was not being as clearly told and we felt needed to be represented in a compelling way. So that's what we're trying to do with this book.
Cy, how did you get involved with the project then?
Good question. A mutual friend of Susie and I just reached out to a bunch of people and said, I have this brilliant friend who's working on this incredible project. Does anyone want to get involved? And so, you know, I contacted her, and then our co-editor and previous guest of your show, Jonathan Walton, is a old friend of mine. We met when we were teenagers in college, and I reached out to him, and it's funny, he says I called him, which I never do. Like our entire like relationship at this point exists over like voice messages, and because we just live in different parts of the city and he has children. And so he was like, Cy's giving me a phone call. This is strange. So then I think that was part of his being convinced that this was something important that he should pay attention to. And so then he called Susie, and we just kind of coalesced around you know, her vision, and she thought we would be a good fit, apparently, because she brought us on. And then we spent, you know, a good couple of months just reaching out to everyone we possibly could, being pretty intentional about trying to get people from across, like Susie was saying, the political spectrum, from different ethnicities, different evangelical and non-evangelical traditions. People are from around the country. And we were pretty blown away by how great the submissions that we got were. Yeah. And then we just went to work on editing them and putting them all together into this book.
Yeah. I love that. I was very impressed by the diversity, you know, yeah, in all the ways, which was really cool to see. I think that always like speaks volumes about a project, you know, that you can bring on these diverse voices and sort of like set a narrative, like, you know, say something with so many different voices. It's really cool. So,
yeah. And to your point about narrative too, that's another way we've been sort of explaining this project to people, is that what we're really hoping to do is sort of reclaim the narrative around what it means to engage politically as a Christian in the United States, and to reimagine what that could look like. So the whole Trump conversation is really just a doorway into a broader conversation that we're trying to have with the book. And I think that also is what brings out the broad array of pieces that we have and topics that we try to cover.
Yeah, because you've had, I mean, you know, this situation in my mind is sort of coalesced. Like we're at a sort of like, it's all come together to have like a bigger, like Trump has caused us to have a bigger conversation about what it means to be a Christian and engage politically. Right.
Yeah. He's a symptom of the problem. He's not the problem.
Right. Totally. Totally. Okay. So Susie, I read your article in the book, on idolatry, and I loved it. And I loved the way that you weaved your story into it. So I'd love to talk to each of you sort of about your stories and what sort of gives you maybe a passion for like even engaging in this work. So do you mind, Susie, sort of talking about, you know, a little of your story and how that brings you to the place you are today?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And thank you for the feedback on the piece. That's always really encouraging to hear that it resonates. So I, going a little bit farther back than I even go in the essay itself, I grew up as a missionary kid in Uzbekistan. So I lived there from age 8 to 18, so pretty formative years. Wow. And speaking of politics, it was a time, it was right after the fall of the Soviet Union that we moved there, and we lived under this sort of Soviet strongman that had been set up and was sort of an authoritarian leader. And some really crazy things happened while we were there, including when I was 13, our home was broken into, my parents were severely beaten. We had to go back to the States for a while to recover from that, and then felt like God was calling us to go back. So that was kind of the context I grew up in, was seeing faith in action in that way and seeing my parents engage so deeply with what they felt God was calling them to do. And then came back to the States for university, ended up feeling after university like God was calling me to go back overseas, and ended up in the Middle East in Lebanon and met my husband there. That was pretty cool. Definitely when I moved overseas, I felt like, that's it. I'm probably not going to meet anybody. It's just going to be me for a while. And then met this amazing guy at a Bible study my second month there. He's Lebanese. And we got married. And our first year of marriage was the year that this sort of trickle of Syrian refugees that were coming into Lebanon became this flood, because the conflict in Syria had just exploded and become so violent and so vicious. And so we felt God calling us to step out of the sort of more traditional ministry that we were doing with churches there, and to try to get involved in more humanitarian response, even though neither of us really had solid training or background in that. And I feel like God was really faithful to provide the mentors that we needed in that, and the training that we needed to be equipped, but we just kind of jumped in and ended up serving through our church's ministry around 450 Syrian families in our immediate community. And then I was working for a local faith-based NGO that was reaching thousands of families across the country. So I would also travel to these other partner churches who were doing the same work that our church was doing. And yes, we did that for a while, and then felt like God was calling us into a new season. And I applied to different graduate school programs, got accepted to the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at Harvard. And actually, Sai and I were just chatting about this recently, that part of my decision to do that was I felt maybe the call to pivot more towards the political sphere. And part of that was, to be quite frank, this frustration in humanitarian work that you feel like you're constantly dealing with these bigger issues that need more than just a band-aid of humanitarian assistance. And so I felt like I needed to equip myself more and learn more about these bigger structures that were creating these problems. And how do we start to talk about, you know, peacemaking? And how do we start to talk about how to dive into sectarian politics and really figure out how to grapple with those issues, and wanting to do that in a way that was also informed by my faith. So I just wrapped up my program at Harvard recently, I guess a couple of years ago now. About a year and a half. It's kind of a blur because I also was
pregnant the year that I graduated. So I graduated 7 months pregnant and then had my first child. And so that, you know, that first year with your baby is kind of a blur.
You've also lived through a pandemic. So, you know, there's that too.
Well, yeah, there's that. I know. I think we're all sort of going through that sort of feeling right now, like where, what is time? What did you say
right.
in my life? And so, yeah, so that really the first thing I did since all of that was this book project. And I was definitely so, so blessed to have Cy and Jonathan come on. I'll be honest, like every time I have a conversation with these guys, I'm just like, wow, how did I? How am I lucky enough to be doing this with these amazing others? And so that's been really cool.
Yeah, that's cool. I love that. I was very curious about your degrees and like why you got the degrees you did. And I assume there was a MK sort of background there, but you know, you never want to.
I saw that between the lines.
Yeah, well, I've that's been funny. Around enough of them, you know. I work at a church where there's a lot of there's a lot of conversation about third culture kids.
Yep.
And a lot of understanding about those things. And so I've come to understand a lot more about that than I did, you know, previously. So yeah, it's good. It's good stuff. I don't want to derail us too much here, but it just occurs to me, like all the things that you were just talking about are things that I have never experienced. Like it's very easy as a white evangelical living in America to sort of sequester yourself in a place where you don't even know anybody that really has different experiences, much less looks that different than you. Do you think that like you being overseas and all that stuff sort of expanded you beyond what you would have living just in America?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that can be a difficult space to be in. I mean, you talked about these conversations on third culture kids, and I'm still learning about what it means to be a third culture kid. And I think that's why that literature exists, is you trying to understand who, your identity. And that's a common thread for all of humanity as well. I think that's a pretty universal thing. That's not, you know, third culture kids don't have a, that's not just about us. So, yeah, but I think that it does cause you to try to wrestle with these bigger questions of where you fit in the world, and trying to locate yourself and connect to experiences that are so vastly different from your own, and trying to develop the empathy that you need to relate. And that connects in a really cool way to this whole project, because to be quite frank, as you know, middle class white woman in the United States, I'm not the one who is most negatively impacted by the kinds of policies that this administration is supporting. And so that, I'll be quite frank, there have been times throughout the course of this project that I kind of wonder, you know, is it really worth it? Like, I could just be sitting enjoying more time with my adorable daughter. Why am I putting myself into this and you know, exposing myself to some of the negative pushback that there's going to be? And I feel like I just have to hold out hope that, one, that it is going to have an impact and, you know, hopefully change some hearts and minds, hopefully be received in love. And two, just recognize that, you know, I think we're all called to step out of our own experiences. And especially in the area of politics, we need to see the experiences of those who are unlike us. We need to see the other and to be able to embrace them and to live sacrificially on their behalf. And I think that's something that is also should be a huge part of a Christian ethic of engaging. You may not hear that in every politics class that you take, but I think as followers of Christ, that should be what defines how we engage politically.
Yeah. I mean, you talk about the incarnation itself is Christ coming to live with us and empathize and understand. Yeah.
Exactly. It's so at the heart of the gospel. I think, yeah.
Yeah, it's good stuff. Okay, Cy, I'm super interested. I would love to hear your story and how you came to this place as well.
Sure. I was also sort of forcibly removed from suburban conservative evangelicalism, which was a huge culture shock. So I was born in Grand Forks, North Dakota, and I moved around a bunch, three different places in Michigan, Illinois, New Jersey, all before I was six. Wow. And then I grew up in New Jersey for simplicity's sake, but I lived there from kindergarten through seventh grade. And then we moved to Zurich, Switzerland, just because of my dad's job.
Okay.
A month before 9/11. And so I then, you know, I was, like I said, forcibly taken out of the kind of just normal white conservative evangelical world that I grew up in, and placed into an international school where people had wildly varying views about the greatness of America and and our choices that we make on the world stage. And I was there, you know, during the beginning of the war in Afghanistan and the war in Iraq. And like, I remember, for instance, when we started, you know, Operation Shock and Awe, when we were bombing Baghdad,
right?
A friend of mine got up in our history class and read an email that a friend of hers living in Baghdad had sent her the night before we started the bombing, basically saying like, I don't know if I'm going to live through the night. Wow. And like, you know, I love you, goodbye. And so that, you know, just couldn't be more different than where I grew up in terms of what I was being exposed to on like more of a personal level. And so I think I just came out of that with, you know, much broader sense of America's place in the world and other people's view, regardless of what I believe myself. I just had heard up close and personal a ton of other people's beliefs. And I think that really prepped me for coming into college back in New York City, where I met Jonathan and a whole lot of other people who just came from, again, wildly different backgrounds than I did. You know, Jonathan grew up on a farm in rural Southern Virginia. And, you know, grew up in a Black Baptist church, and like just having people like that who I met just through the InterVarsity group that I was in.
Yeah.
Speaking into my life and being extremely patient with my kind of latent implicit racism and everything else that I just learned growing up, unfortunately, right, in the US. I was able to, again, like really broaden my perspective, be able to see things from other people's points of view, really wanted to, you know, dig into them and learn and follow kind of the biblical commandment to be slow to anger and quick to listen. And they taught me how to do that. And, you know, from there, I went to law school. I worked for a court for a couple of years. For the past 2.5 years or so, I've been a public defender in the child welfare system, which I know you know a lot about. And so I, you know, when Susie reached out to me, or not Susie, when the friend of ours reached out to me about this, I just thought this was a project that I really wanted to be involved in, because I think it is so important for us, in especially in the white American church, but just in the kind of conservative evangelical church in general, to be hearing from our brothers and sisters all over the world, realizing that we are a tiny minority of the global church of Jesus, right, and that there are many other perspectives that we need to consider. And that we, you know, I another point of the book was just to kind of push back against the general media narrative that Christians just back Trump no matter what. Like, we really honestly don't. There are, you know, even the 19% of white evangelicals who didn't vote for Trump, that is millions of people.
Right.
And that's not talking about non-white evangelicals or non-evangelicals. You know, like, there's just a whole world out there that people are not paying attention to.
Yeah, I really appreciate that, Cy. I think that's an important point to all of this. And I think it's so easy to get lost in the voices that are loudest, you know, and it's like they represent everybody. And it's just like, it's not true on any level, like anywhere, you know. There's such nuance to all this stuff.
And
I really think, like we talked about earlier, not even not knowing people outside of our ourselves, but not realizing that our faith, like you said, is global, and that we're a very small portion of that global faith, yeah. And never learning theology or how people read the Bible from another's perspective,
yeah.
I think makes us less in general. So that's good. I appreciate that. Gosh, a public defender in the child welfare system is, yep. I didn't realize, I may have read that in your bio, but I did not quite connect all that. That is a, you see a lot of stuff.
That's an understatement. Yeah. You see a lot of stuff is true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My wife's a social worker, so she's been in that system at different points. And because I'm married to her, I'm basically a social worker. So, you know,
that's how that works.
Okay. Awesome. Okay. I want to maybe let's step back for a second, from like getting into the nitty gritty of this conversation. I think for a long time, my de facto position was sort of like, it doesn't really matter, right? Like politics, like I'm a Christian. I can't vote in good conscience for a lot of these people. And I think it was really easy for me to just sort of like step out, right? Like I don't have to do anything. Technically, it's part of my rights to not do anything, honestly. And so what would you say to that position from a Christian perspective?
I mean, I think I would initially respond, and then I'd love to hear your response too, Si. I guess initially sort of respond with just a story for how this idea hit home for me that as Christians, I think it is important that we do engage politically, because maybe similar to you in some ways, I was actually sort of raised in this atmosphere that we don't engage with politics. It's a conscious decision to not engage because it's sort of just this dirty, divisive business and can even serve as an impediment to the gospel. You know, it just divides people. And so why would we even choose to insert ourselves into that? And I remember in high school, it was my junior year in Uzbekistan, and we were sitting in class and all of a sudden the cell reception cut out and the internet cut out, and we're trying to figure out what was going on. And we found out later that the government was clamping down because a massacre had occurred in one of the major cities. There had been a protest against the government, and the president told the people to gather in this one square that he was going to address them. And instead he sent in gunmen and just mowed down men, women, and children. And to this day, we don't know how many people were lost. It's estimated it was as many as 1,500 people. And that was a really formative moment for me, because I realized you can't be the church in a place and not address that kind of suffering and not speak to the structures that allow that to happen and the injustices that are occurring. And you need to have a voice in those moments. And again, this goes back to, I think, being able to put yourself in the place of those who are suffering and to allow that to inform, in this case, your vote or however you engage the system. So, yeah, I think I won't jump in too much to how Si answers, because I feel like he has a good way of talking about this too. But just this idea that political systems are always going to impact someone in a really significant way. It may not be you, but there is someone out there that it does affect. And again, I think as Christians, we're called to see beyond just our immediate space into those outward spaces. So yeah, and I think Jesus cares about politics to the extent that he cares about people. We don't want this to be about partisanship at all. In fact, I think that's a common misconception about this book, is people think that because we're trying to present this other side of the story, that just because you're a Christian doesn't mean you have to vote for Trump. That doesn't mean that we're now sidling up to the other party. In fact, what we're trying to critique is this idea that as Christians, we should be tied to any one party. That is such a dangerous concept. And historically, you can see so many examples of how that leads to a lack of critical engagement that can lead you down a really, really detrimental path. So that's kind of my initial response to that question.
That's good.
One of our authors kind of addresses this head on, Greg Coles. And, you know, he says, like a common criticism is just let faith be faith and politics be politics and just stop making this complicated and hard. And, you know, he just says not talking about something doesn't inoculate you against its dangers. And, you know, the fact is that you have the right to vote. And if you don't, that is implicitly a way of kind of condoning the status quo, or at least some aspect of the status quo, you know, saying that this is, I'm not, you know, I'm not going to make a decision, even if it's two people that you completely don't like. I'm not going to make a decision about who would be better overall. I'm not going to do any of that. It's just let it be what it is. And, you know, we are not in a place in this world, like according to the Bible, that is like neutral for us. It's not like if we do nothing, then nothing happens to us. We just kind of stay the same, right? But everything around you, the society around you, is trying to disciple you into something, is trying to teach you something. My old pastor I had, John Tyson, would always talk about how there's really no such thing as a neutral space.
Yeah.
Right. You're going to be taught things. And if we are not thinking about how our faith affects politics, then we are just going to kind of absorb by osmosis the politics of the world around us. You know, that's how you have a white church that's been for so long complicit in so many of the awful things that this country has done to other people, is basically we're going to use our faith to justify our politics instead of subordinating our politics to our faith.
So we
need to be talking about this stuff.
Yeah, I totally agree. I've been thinking a lot about discipleship, because it's a word thrown around in Christian churches a lot. And for many, many Christians, discipleship just means teaching people about the Bible and about theology.
Honestly,
that's how I learned undergrad. That's how I learned theology. It was like, here's a bunch of principles, learn them and then write them down. You know what I mean? Like, that's your test. And discipleship is about like a full, like how we engage the world in every single thing that we do. And I don't know that there's a real good Christian theology around that.
Oh, I was just going to say, I mean, I agree. I think with this book, we're trying to start to dig into that and figure out how can we do this better. I mean, there is some good stuff out there. And actually, one of the models for this book has been Walter Brueggemann's book, The Prophetic Imagination, where he talks about how the role of the prophet is to critique the status quo and try to bring your community in a place that is more in line with the character and rule and reign of God. And so that's sort of the model that I use for political engagement. And not just in the States, folks that I was mentored by in Lebanon, I attended the Arab Baptist Theological Seminary while I was there, which is so cool to be discipled by people whose faith is from that context.
Yeah.
And so one of my mentors, Martin Akkad, he has done phenomenal work in peacemaking in Lebanon, our work with Muslim Christian relations, and now is pretty involved in some of the activism against the really corrupt government, as the world has seen, you know, with the recent explosion. And so that it's folks like that who have really informed the way that I engage politically.
Sai, did you want to add something to that?
I was listening to the great things that two of you were saying, and I forgot what I was going to say.
When it comes back, let us know, you know. Totally.
Yeah, please, Sai. Don't let us miss that opportunity.
I need to stop listening to you two so much.
Discipleship. I've been recently critiqued by people for, you know, discipleship, or like discipleship is something we talk about, like, because I'm in a lot of pastors' meetings, right? We'll just like pastors hang out, you know, and it's always like people are writing books on discipleship, and like, I don't know, maybe we should stop writing books on it and just like live with people, you know, and just like, yeah, live life together, I guess.
Yeah.
That's one of the things that I like a lot about Jonathan's ministry, which you've talked about at length on the time when he was a guest, is that he is writing, he is, you know, publicly thinking about things and trying to get, you know, his ideas out there. But the vast majority of what he does is just working with college students and trying to get them to, you know, be the church wherever they are, which I think more people need to do more of that and less, you know, conference circuiting. I think we'd be in a better discipleship place, probably.
Yeah. I agree. Discipleship's hard, though. It means making yourself vulnerable to another human being.
Yeah.
You know, it means failing in front of other people sometimes. So it's a lot messier than just like standing on a stage and preaching, because
yeah,
you can be whoever you want then. You
know? Yeah, it's true.
Yeah, and I think that whole, to your point, Curry, I think it goes back to this sort of false sacred secular divide. I feel like Christianity has fallen into this dualism in the United States and in, you know, this part of the world. And I think that, when you look at how Christ did discipleship, it was, as you said, just living together and eating together. And I, you know, it's been so refreshing working with someone like Jonathan, who he kind of, to be honest, he sort of came in onto this project as sort of like our champion, like, because he, you know, he has his book out there and he's done the circuit and folks know his name. Yeah. And it's been so incredible and encouraging to work with someone like him, who is so well-grounded and just a real human being. Like, that was what I told my husband the first time I got off the phone with him. I said, he is a genuine person. And he always makes it a human to human connection. And I feel like maybe part of what keeps him grounded is that ministry is still the day to day living together with people and going through life together. And I think, yeah, I know for my husband and I, part of what kept us grounded when we were in Lebanon was just being out, you know, I could be in the office writing up grant proposals. And to be honest, it can be pretty easy to get a little bit full of yourself when you're doing humanitarian work, like get this white savior complex going for you. I feel like part of what keeps you grounded is, you know, we would go out every night and visit families in their homes and just sit with them. And I think we needed that human to human connection of just being with them and learning from them and really entering into their experiences. And I think that's part of also the bubble that white suburbia puts you in, is you lose that connection. And that again, is kind of a scary, dangerous thing.
Yeah, I very much agree. I think that's good. Yeah. Something I've also been thinking about, and maybe y'all have seen this as well, or maybe can speak to this, is that on the other side of this equation is this notion that voting on November 3rd is like the only moral decision you will make in your entire life. And the whole of your morality is based on that one moment. Have y'all seen, or am I just on Twitter too much?
I think it's implicit in what a lot of people say, right? Like or in a lot of the arguments that people have online, that you are, the volume and the intensity with which we are arguing over what happens on November 3rd, I think can indicate to ourselves or to other people that this is, you know, the only and the most important moral decision you will make.
Right.
But no, I don't know that I've heard anyone articulate that explicitly.
Okay. Yeah. And it just becomes part of the conversation. Like, oh, you're not, I mean, a lot of conservatives that I've seen, for instance, have just talked about like, well, if you're not voting for Donald Trump, then A, B, and C, and it's mostly the abortion conversation, right? I mean, it's like, then you're morally bankrupt because you have made a decision that has, you know, and it's kind of,
what you're saying.
Yeah, I guess it's kind of mind boggling to me that you could couch somebody's entire moral fiber into a single vote for something you're not even doing. I mean, like, you also didn't make that decision. You don't make those decisions, you know? And so as Christians engage in the world, like if our only engagement in the world is checking a box, then we've definitely lost it. Right.
Yeah. And I mean, so when it comes to the abortion question, we do go right at that in the book with a few different essays. And we have a piece from David French in particular.
Mind blowing.
Yeah. He's a lifelong Republican, you know, and he's just a never Trumper, effectively. He's been in marched in the pro-life marches. He's done every pro-life thing you can think of. But he said he wasn't voting for Trump, and he was accused on Twitter of having the blood of unborn children on his hands.
Right.
And he goes through in a lot of detail as to why that's not actually the case, and why, you know, the appointment of justices and Republican policies have had little to no effect on abortion. And even if if Roe versus Wade was overturned, it would also be a probably less than people know, a fairly minimal effect on the actual right. number of abortions that are happening in the country. And he just has like a much more, I think, realistic view than the people who are saying, you know, he's a very practical view. How are we actually going to reduce abortions as opposed to the people who are just kind of, like you said, I think somewhat irrationally putting all of the weight of whether or not you care about human life on how you vote. And I think that's ultimately a political move, right? And it's a political move that we have absorbed from the rest of the culture around us, right? The idea that you have to make the biggest possible deal out of any given election, which both sides want you to do, right? All the political operatives want to make the biggest possible deal that you can out of any given election. And that's not at all to say that this election is not a big deal.
Right.
I definitely think it is. I just mean to exaggerate the importance and the effect of an election on whatever your particular point is. Like, that is a move that the RNC and the DNC have taught us. It's not anything that Jesus has taught us.
And I think too, there's some other great sort of pieces that address that point in an indirect way. I think Janelle Austin's piece, she wrote a beautiful piece called My Hope for America. She's involved in a lot of racial reconciliation projects and just a phenomenal theologian. And she talks about the importance of engaging at a local level politically, that you need to also be involved in local elections. And a lot of times that's going to have an even more bigger impact on your community than at the national level in some ways. Again, not to downplay the importance of this election. I think the fact that we, you know, push ourselves to get this book out there shows that we do think this election is significant. And I have to say too, one thing I definitely want to emphasize is that it's, you know, part of why we're doing this, it's not just important to America, because I do sometimes get a little bit frustrated by our sort of ethnocentrism and how much America sees itself as being sort of the center of the world. Having said that, I have had to reconcile myself to the fact that we do have a disproportionate impact on what happens in the rest of the world. America is the global superpower today. And so I have friends I've been talking to in Lebanon who are saying that the government there and the political crisis there, essentially they're just waiting to see what happens with the election in the United States, because it's all going to depend on who's in power here and how they choose to influence what happens there, because it's a small country and they're sort of caught up in this bigger sort of geopolitical chess game. And so, I mean, I think it's significant also for what's going on around the world. But having said that, another theme you'll see in our pieces on foreign policy that we include is this common refrain of, well, if I'm honest, if you look at foreign policy in the Middle East, for example, not much has changed across any administration. It's been pretty consistently for the past, you know, couple decades at least, just going in there and kind of, you know, all kinds of destruction and I think a lack of critical engagement and being able to. So one of the pieces is on the moral superiority of the United States and being able to recognize that as the United States, we're not infallible, and we don't have the right a lot of times to make some of these decisions. So in terms of, you know, who lives and who has war inflicted on them. And Yeah,
that's good. That's helpful. I think that's one of those issues, foreign policy. And that's what makes voting hard. Like, foreign policy is this huge piece of the puzzle, right? Like, I mean, that affects the entire world. And yet I don't think there's a lot of places to readily access like helpful information about one candidate's foreign policy or how that even affects, you know, the globe, you know.
It ends up being a lot of speculation based on their record, right?
Like,
which is a complicated thing, especially with someone like Donald Trump, where he literally had no record.
There is no record, right?
Yeah, there's absolutely no record.
Right.
I mean, now he has a record, but he didn't the first time around.
Right.
One of the pieces I particularly liked, at least this can help a little bit with like directionally how you think about foreign policy, is we have one piece called Kingdom Accountability, and it's basically about how, you know, there is no feedback loop to our government for all the people who are affected by our foreign policy. Like, they don't vote, right? They're not involved in the democratic election process. They are not heard.
Right.
And so for us, especially as Christians who have people to whom we are at least supposed to be connected to overseas through our common faith and the fact that we are all part of the body of Christ, we should be some of the biggest advocates for those people, right? Like we should be the ones raising the voices of the people who are negatively affected, the vulnerable people who are negatively affected by our foreign policy, and you know, create an accountability in this country that is based on you know, the kingdom that we are supposed to be a part of.
Yeah, that's good. That's good stuff. Yeah, it's just stuff is complicated, and like this election just feels so much. There's just so much to it. It's complicated. I really can't emphasize the David French article enough. Because I've listened to him on, like, he is a Second Amendment guy through and through. I mean, that dude is you know, I just listened to him sort of just roll that out, which I'm not a big gun guy, but I just like listen to him roll that out. I mean, he is very, very conservative. And like, if you look at the statistics on abortions and those sort of like the numbers just like do not lie, you know? And yet I had some, a group of ladies on Instagram, just, you know, sort of influencers in the world, just sort of made it known that they were not voting for Donald Trump. And like, I got lost in the comments, and it was just disheartening, because that one thing is all anybody can sort of think about. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't talk about Trump's foreign policies or how, you know, pulling out troops. So, you know, there's just like all this other stuff just doesn't come into to the conversation like it should.
Yeah. And it becomes vitriolic and awful. And we do also, I mean, we have a couple of essays that come right after David French's essay that talk about all of the other things that also affect abortion, apart from just whether or not you can ban it.
Right.
You know, like all of the things that affect policies that affect the decisions that parents make, or that when they, you know, when they are thinking about abortion, and how you know, a good argument can be made that Joe Biden or the Democratic policy platform is much better on a lot of those issues.
Yeah.
And also, again, going just to talk about that section in the book a little bit more, because I agree that it is such a critical part of the conversation. And I think that certainly from friends and family that I have and know who have, you know, who voted for Trump in the past election and are currently planning to vote for him, a lot of times it does boil down to this one issue. And I think we try to also, you know, in a sort of cursory way, unfortunately, because we do cover a broad number of topics, but another piece in there is by Randall Balmer, and that's us trying to get into some of the history, because he's such a phenomenal historian, and he's gone into correspondence between different leaders who sort of created this platform, and does a great job of just sort of unmasking the fact that the way that this became the key issue was actually initially related to the topic of segregation of schools. And that Christian schools who are choosing to remain segregated didn't want to lose their tax exemption status. And so it's sort of this, unfortunately, really sinister story that you get into, where it's not about what you think it's about. And tragically, I think that trend continues today, that this topic of abortion is being instrumentalized in the political discussion. And I think oftentimes it's not about what you think it's about. And that's not to say there aren't people who are pro-life because they genuinely care. I think that's the problem. I think it's that they do genuinely care, and they're being used as pawns in this bigger political game. And so again, we wanted to try to unmask that. And I think people deserve to know that side of the story, and to allow that to inform their vote.
Yeah. Yeah, very much. I very much agree. And I do think there is honest sincerity there. And they believe, a lot of Trump supporters believe, that's the only way to end abortions. And yeah.
Right.
Yeah. It's just not accurate, I guess. Especially as somebody who, you know, we've adopted, we're big in the foster care system. Like, that system's tough and broken, but I think there could be so much more done in those systems by like building up parents, you know, to care for their children, you know? David French even just mentions how, like, nobody, like, if you look at the breakdowns of it, nobody, like, really, really wants abortions to be happening, right?
Right.
It's not, or maybe there's like a few very vocal people out there, but the vast majority of Americans do not want that happening. A lot of women are just not equipped to engage, you know, like have a child and aren't at the place. So,
yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, one of our main two kind of like main groups of people that we were writing for, you know, one is for people who have voted for Republicans their whole lives and think that their faith calls them to do that, but might feel a little bit stuck with Trump,
yeah.
you
right.
know,
yeah.
and just trying to say to them, there are genuine ways to vote for someone other than him that are completely in line with your faith and that other people are doing with just as much of a desire as you have to follow Jesus,
yeah.
and that there, you know, you will find things that you resonate with and things that challenge you in the book. If you come from that perspective, you will also find things in the book with which you resonate and that challenge you. If you are, you know, you're coming from a completely anti-Trump perspective, right? But there, you know, I think what you will find then is just a lot of people with whom you have a common goal, a common way of thinking that may not be as prominent within, you know, your immediate church or something. Like we've had a lot of people write in and say, I'm so glad that I have this because I have felt like such an outsider. And this really has, you know, brought me some sense of shared, a community again.
Yeah. Yeah. That's good. I feel like you're adding nuance to a conversation that's specifically not nuanced for yeah. a reason, you know?
Right. Right. That's what we're trying to do. Exactly.
Yeah. And I think that's a worthy goal, and it's a contentious time for a lot of this stuff. And the partisanship, going back to, I know we talked about this earlier, Susie, but just like the straight partisanship that we have like fallen into, I guess, is just such an unhealthy way of like bifurcating sort of the whole conversation.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that, you know, there's also a section in the book just to give folks a flavor for what we try to cover. So there's also a section on called divorce. And we also talk about this in the introduction to the book, that it's so sad and again, tragic that we've sort of forgotten this truth that you can disagree with someone and not hate them. And I think that's also a common misconception about the book is, you know, we're coming for Trump supporters and this is us, you know, trolling them. And that's not the intention at all. If anything, it's coming from a place of love that, you know, we hope that those that we know of can read this and maybe have, you know, thoughtfully listen and, you know, do with it what they may. Certainly it's coming from a place of conviction for each of us. But also it's our way of sort of holding out hope that we can hope for better things in this election, that we can hope for better things in terms of our witness as a church. So I think, you know, I would love to see more love brought to the conversation. And there's a phrase that Jonathan uses. He talks about being lovingly disruptive. And I feel like I'm going to hold on to that one because I feel like that really captures what we're trying to do is just, we're going to ask some tough questions. We're going to ask people to dive deep with us and to wrestle with us through these pages, but we want it to come from a place of love, and let's have the conversation. Let's not just shut each other out and, you know, plug our ears and scream past one another. Let's dig deep.
Yeah. I you mentioned a word there that I think we should just sort of sit with and maybe just explore a little bit, which is witness. I think that's something that maybe Christians don't think about enough when we have these conversations. Like, what does the witness of the church look like to the world? Can y'all just talk a little bit just about that?
Yeah, I think to your point about witness, Curry, I think that really was an important motivation and piece also in why we wanted to do this book. I feel like particularly speaking to people in my generation, I see a lot of friends leaving the church just out of a place of disillusionment and hurt. And not necessarily that they've, you know, they don't believe in God anymore, or that they've lost their faith, but it's hard for them to find a community of fellowship around issues that they're really passionate about, like justice. And I think reflecting that aspect of who God is and seeing that lived out more faithfully in our communities. And then also it makes me sad because oftentimes those are also friends who would ideally love to be able to bring their friends to church and to be able to have that be a place that they could connect to and meet God and find him. And they don't really feel like that space is being created. And so I think, I suspect that a lot of that has to do with the current state of our politics and this sort of, I think, ungodly alliance between our partisanship and our faith. And so again, that's something we're trying to critique in this book. And so the stakes are high in terms of how we choose to engage. I feel like this has kind of become a theme of our conversation. It's not just about the United States, it's about the world. It's not just about representing a party. We're not calling for aligning yourself with any one party. It's about representing the kingdom of God, and not that, you know, we hope for a theocracy or any kind of utopia. It's not calling for that or believing that that's a thing. You know, we're always caught in this tension that I know theologians talk about the, you know, already, but not yet. And I think that's how we should engage politically. But I think that there's a lot that we need to look critically at and hopefully come to a better place at.
Yeah, it's good.
I think it's part of the reason that we were trying to like sort of untie the knot that people find themselves in when it comes to issues like abortion and everything is, you know, if when you talk about this witness to the rest of the country, like if you think that, you know, God has called you to do everything that you can to save the lives of unborn children, and the only way to do that is to vote for the Republicans and to overturn Roe versus Wade or whatever the issue is that you might be right. stuck on, then like none of this stuff about witnessing matters. You know what I mean? Like it's like it's like who ultimately cares? Like whether or not people are hearing me or believing me or whatever, I'm doing what is right and I need to keep doing it. And like, God will vindicate me and I will be, you know, others will be convinced. And if they're not, then they won't be convinced. I just have to stick to the truth and stick to the good fight that I'm fighting. Mm-hmm. And so that was part of the motivation, at least for me, for us getting into the weeds on issues like that. But, you know, we've also had, I've heard stories of a couple of different people, you know, saying who walked away from the church, you know, even years ago, basically saying, I'm so happy to be able to read this book just to hear something other than what I walked away from. Mm. And so I think you're definitely right. She's definitely right. So we have a pastor in the book who actually writes about how he believed that in 2016, you know, he was casting his vote on behalf of other people because he, as a white, straight Christian man in America, wouldn't really lose anything if Trump was elected or not. It wouldn't affect him either way. And he just talks about how wrong he was about that because, you know, while he recognizes that other people have lost, you know, more than he has seen so many people leave his church. He has seen in both directions, right? People leaving because they can't stand just the general Christian support for Trump, and people leaving because he has said things against the Trump administration. Right. And like the division and the just the exodus from the church that has happened because of Christian support of this administration.
Yeah.
I don't know. Once you bring up the topic of witness, it's like that. I feel like there's so much that could be said. But another thing that comes to mind is, and again, going back to this concept of what it means to be pro-life. And I know we're not the first ones to say this. I think a lot of Christians are saying this now and recognizing this, that if you're going to talk about being pro-life, you need to be pro all of life. And so that's part of why another section in the book is on immigration and immigration policy. And one of the pieces that really hit me hard is a story of a young woman who grew up in the United States as a dreamer, well, as an undocumented immigrant. And she shares a bit of her story and just, you know, with everything going on in this country, you know, horrifying stories of hearing families separated at the borders. And yeah, you just have to ask yourself, are we really representing life in all of its flourishing? And so I think that's also such an important piece to our witness. If we're going to say that we care about life and we mean it in terms of the wholeness of all of life, how should that you know, flow out into all of these other policy platforms that we support. And I don't just think it's immigration policy. I think it, you know, overlaps into healthcare, and it overlaps into, you know, how we view the gap between the haves and the have-nots. And, you know, it goes out into every sphere. And so that's another thing that we want to be able to come together to discern as a community.
Yeah. I think that's good. I think that's important. What does it mean that the image of God is on all persons, you know, everyone? What does that mean to engage the world in that way? Right.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Y'all, this has been so great to get to talk to y'all about all this stuff. And I really appreciate the work. The book's helpful. How would people best go about sort of finding out about the book and all that?
Keepingthefaithbook.com and on Instagram at We Are Keeping the Faith. There's a We Are Keeping the Faith Just Keeping the Faith Facebook page that you can like. And that's where I would go. All the links to buy the books on Amazon and Apple and Barnes & Noble are on the keepingthefaithbook.com website.
Awesome. Love it. Okay, so I do have two final questions I do with everyone. Are y'all okay jumping into that?
Sure.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, so awesome. My first question is, what is the strangest job that you have ever had?
So I'll start with this one for me, because I think mine, the summer after Jonathan, our co-editor, graduated from college, he had done all this kind of work in fighting sex trafficking and labor slavery and working with displaced kids in Uganda, like all this stuff that he had raised money and awareness for in college. And he knew that he was just going to keep doing that after he graduated, but he didn't know where yet. So like he was maybe going to work with World Vision, maybe with InterVarsity, which is where he ended up, you know, it's a couple different groups that he looked at. And for that summer, I hadn't graduated. I was a couple years behind him. I just worked for him. Like I was just helping him continue to do the stuff that we were doing in college anyways. But like, I was basically an unpaid intern for a guy who didn't have a job. So it was like, and it was totally natural for us. Like it was just like what we were doing the rest of the year in college anyways, just keep doing it over the summer. But yeah, it was a bizarre thing to explain to like later interviewers on a resume or whatever, you know?
That's pretty amazing. They were like, you probably needed a little more career counseling, you know, back in the day.
Yeah. Yeah.
Good. That's awesome.
Yeah. I guess for me, probably the strangest job that I've had. So unfortunately being an MK, I never really got the whole summer job experience. We were always sort of bouncing around, like visiting different churches in the summer. And so I just kind of lived out of a suitcase during those months. But, so after college, when we started out in Lebanon with, working with refugees there, and my husband and I had already started the ministry through our local church. And one of my professors invited me to come on to work at the faith-based NGO that I mentioned. But what they needed me to do was just to come and go through these receipts of what families had used their food vouchers for at the local grocery stores, because the humanitarian community was trying to make this argument to move away from like food baskets that you give of like actual food towards giving families food vouchers so they could go and have their own choice about, you know, restore some agency in terms of what they want to provide for their families through that. And so literally for just hours a day, I would go through these receipts and come up with a system to like figure out what were they spending their food vouchers on and what kinds of things were they buying. And it was just that kind of busy work. But the cool thing is I was just so grateful to be doing it. I thought, you know, if there's any way that I can contribute to this, that's cool. But it was pretty tedious. I mean, yeah, it was definitely just getting it done.
That sounds wild. That's awesome. Okay, so my final question then is, what is one piece of advice you would give to somebody looking to bring God's kingdom more into their work?
I would say I would just focus as much as you can on like real tangible needs of people and meeting them. I think so much of our conversations around work within the church is just like, how do you like make more of your coworkers Christians?
Right.
And which is like, I'm not, yeah, tell people about Jesus. Fine. Of course, do that. That is extremely important. But we skip over so much of this stuff that says, like, you know, where God says, if you see, you know, your neighbor in need and you tell them to stay warm and be well fed, then the love of God is not in you.
Right.
Right. And we don't, you know, it sort of doesn't occur to us to go then, like, okay, well, if we're not paying attention to those needs, where is it that the love of God is not in me? Well, like, that's a pretty, it sounds like a fairly important thing to pay attention to. If you are a disciple of Jesus, if Jesus is telling you that this thing that a lot of us are doing, which is not paying attention to the human needs of our neighbors, that means that you have, like, missed a giant part of what it means to be his follower. I would say get involved in efforts to help people as much as possible, care mm-hmm. about your coworkers and their personal needs, and don't hyper-spiritualize everything.
Yeah, that's good. That's helpful.
Yeah, I think for me, again, it goes back to the idea, the theological notion of bringing society and the community around us more in line with the character and rule and reign of God. And the way that we do that through our work is so multifaceted. And, you know, if we reflect, as you touched on earlier, the Imago Dei, if we're created in the image of God and God is a creator, I think, you know, the theology of our work and that task of creating is, I mean, there's so much to that. My husband is a civil engineer, and so he helps construct cities. And I think, you know, to Sai's point, yes, of course, the relationships he develops with people are, you know, one of the most important aspects of his project. But I think it's also significant that he helps build cities. And I think that he glorifies and brings honor to God by doing that. Especially, you know, we talk about what's going to come next for us and will God call us to a place like Syria? And we talk about what could it look like to be trying to rebuild society as he's also physically rebuilding the places that people dwell in. And, you know, I think of artists and musicians and all the different ways that, you know, everything that we do can bring honor and glory to God and point to him. And I think you need to be faithful to who God created you to be in the specific and unique way that you reflect him. But then again, keeping that emphasis on people ultimately.
Yeah. That's great. Amen to both y'all. The theology of hustle. It's good stuff. So thanks so much for making time for me. And it was awesome to get to hear from both y'all. Thanks for the work that you're doing.
Thank you so much for having us. It was a great conversation. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no, thank you so much. It's been an honor.
Well, I hope you enjoyed hearing from Susie and Sai, and just, I really encourage you to check out this book. I think there's a lot of great stuff in here. They get into some awesome things in this book, and I think lay it out in, like, a really understandable way, a really readable way. And so I encourage you to check that out. I have all those links in the show notes below where you can find everything they have going on. And I just, yeah, I encourage you in this season of just, like, charity for other people, have grace with others, and let's have good conversations about what it looks like to build God's kingdom in grace-filled ways with one another. I think that's what we need to be doing. I encourage you to do that and to show that to others. And yeah, now is also a great time to go to the bottom of your iTunes app. You can leave a rating and review there, which just helps get the word out about the podcast and lets me know you're listening. And I really appreciate that. So do all that for me. And until next time, get out there and hustle.